Right. Good morning, folks. Hello.
Morning.
Good to hear real voices there. All right. So, how are you all today?
Tired.
All right. Well, are you sad to be putting Shell Lab in the past? You're gonna miss TSH?
Absolutely not.
I'm sure that's just one random voice, and you don't all agree with that.
I second that.
Now, why is that?
Miss TSH already.
I don't know.
I borderline went insane.
I like structure, and that lab, like, at least when it comes to what to do first, like sequentially, was very confusing.
Agreed.
That's true. It's true. You know, I think that a lot of times programming assignments like, have very much like step one, step two, step three, step four. There's a lot of like interrelated parts here. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of like problems in the world are not always just like a 1, 2, 3, 4 order, and things are interrelated. So I think we try and like give you, you know, your early programming assignments to have a real like clear order and steps and all that. I think a lot of software really is not quite like intro programming assignments. So it gets pretty painful at times. Patrick says now there's nothing left to do. Gonna miss TSH, huh? Well, yeah, it can get complicated and such, but such is the nature of processes, well, especially multiple processes doing stuff at the same time, managing them. But if you think this is complicated, operating system kernels are way more complicated. And of course you'll be taking operating systems class. But I think you hopefully have the, you know, concepts and at least some amount of C programming experience to help you go forward in those sort of challenges coming up. I think you probably did learn some stuff, whether you enjoyed it or not. Am I right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, sometimes that's how it goes. So, today, I'm planning to, continue our discussion of virtual memory. I have updated our schedule. Let me see if I can show this to you real quick. Where is that going to be? You think the screen sharing stuff is easy? Here we go. Okay. Our schedule, that we love to check out. I have us finishing virtual memory, stuff today. And then, Friday begins our return to chapter 3, where we'll go back into, digging more into programs with GDB and, really focusing on function calls or procedure calls and stack memory and exactly how that works, which is you've seen a little bit of in Bomb Lab, but we're going to go into in more detail. And as a part of Attack Lab, which involves, it's sort of similar to Bomb Lab, and you'll be using GDB a lot. But in this case, you will be, instead of just providing normal input to a program like with Bomb Lab, you will be overflowing and attacking that program, exploiting bugs in that program to get it to do what you need it to do. So I think a lot of folks find that an enjoyable challenge, and also an introduction to some computer security topics that are pretty exciting in today's field and where we have good opportunities for you, especially at UNO, where we have a lot of cybersecurity courses and programs. So, that's starting Friday. We'll return to Chapter 3 and get the Attack Lab going. And I think you all have heard that next week you have 3 days of class and then a 4-day weekend that has been expanded. So April 9th and 10th, Thursday and Friday, will be class holidays for you all. So what are your questions about where we stand?
Wait, I'm sorry, just to clarify, it's the 9th and the 10th, no class?
That's right. That is the announcement. Now, the 10th was originally scheduled as a holiday, but they added the 9th as a holiday. That's a recent change.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I believe that was announced. Did y'all get that announcement?
I saw the 9th. I just didn't know about the 10th.
Yeah. I mean, in this case, you know, the 9th is a Thursday, and, you know, this class doesn't meet on Thursday, so it doesn't really change this particular class, but I thought I'd mention that since presumably many of you have Thursday classes also. So let me get our slides back. So virtual memory. Let's see, what do y'all remember about this from last class or in general? Virtual memory, what is this?
It's like a backup of a backup in case there's like too much usage of your actual, kind of like if there's overflow. I may be wrong on that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Overflow is kind of got a different meaning. So we'll be getting to that. But I appreciate you putting it out there. But what were you saying before? I think what you're getting at with backup to a backup is just sort of saying, you know, we're sort of like overselling the available memory can use the disk for excess memory space and hope, you know, and often get away with it a lot. So yeah, that is one of the implications of virtual memory, is that a computer and a process can act like it has much more memory space than it really does. And as long as it doesn't really like push that boundary too much, it works out fine. And I think that actually is about where we left off talking about, well, okay, you know, virtual memory as a tool for caching. If you just see the physical memory as a cache against this larger virtual memory set. So all of this involves a lot of looking up addresses, translating addresses, stuff that might seem really inefficient and complicated, and it is kind of complicated. You know, we've got all these like mappings between, okay, is this a physical page or a virtual page? Is this valid or not? There's this whole page table with bits describing whether it's a valid page or not. It is really adding a bunch of complication. You know, the old model that I presented was simply physical memory addressing, where it's just CPU requests an address. I want page 4. Boom, you got page 4. That's it. No translating. Where is that page really located? Is it cached or not? So nice and simple, but only really effective for simple machines that do one thing. So, you know, since really several weeks ago when I started talking about processes, you know, I've made this whole claim that our modern computers really need multiple processes and lots of things going on at once. And virtual address is a big part of what makes that possible, to have lots of processes on the system. They each have tons of memory available, and they generally coexist pretty well. Everything works great, except when it doesn't. So let's talk a little more about when it doesn't go well. So we would say, this seems terribly inefficient, but because of locality, which is a principle and a tendency for programs to, you know, utilize the same memory repeatedly, utilize nearby memory, this caching system can work out well because of locality. So we would describe the memory that a program is using at a certain point in time. You know, a process could have, I don't know, let's say like 2 gigabytes of memory allocated, like tons of memory. But at any given time, what it's really actively doing at that time, you know, it's in some loop that's computing something, or whatever it is that you're presenting on the screen. It's just there's only a certain amount that you can like present to the user at once. So even for a program with a large amount of memory allocated, some part of that is really active at a certain point in time. You know, it's getting used by the processor, you know, both for reads and writes. So that set that's really actively being used, we'll call the working set. So that's really what is being accessed by the processor, and really what needs to be accessed quickly to avoid slowing down the program. So and that working set size, typically bringing that size down smaller will allow a program to run faster. And using, you know, good temporal locality, meaning everything's close to all the memory and uses next to each other, that is ends up working well for caching, because our cache blocks are sometimes, you know, large and will grab both the memory being used and the stuff right next to it. So when the working set size is less than main memory size, everything's great, because everything will be cached and those memory accesses will be fast. Well, it says here, good performance for one process after compulsory misses, which is to say, yeah, that first time, you know, nothing starts out in memory. Everything has to get loaded off the disk. So that very beginning is the compulsory loading stuff up into memory and caches, sometimes called a cold cache. But that has to happen once. And, you know, you probably noticed that certain large programs, to start them up, takes a little while, or maybe even just starting up your computer might take, you know, several seconds or minutes. But once it's up and running, it tends to, you know, work pretty well and stay, you know, have things happen quickly. Like, you know, if it takes 5 seconds to start up a program or 30 seconds to start up your computer, you're probably not like outraged. But if you're in the middle of using your web browser and it like pauses for 5 seconds while you try and do something, that would be sort of outrageously slow, right? So I think on some level you're already used to like startup times being a little more than delays while using something. So in that sense, I think you're already sort of aware of this compulsory miss at startup time. I don't know. Is that true? That seem normal?
Yep.
Yeah.
So, but at the bottom, thrashing. Have you heard this term before? I think I actually kind of snuck it in at the very end of last class. So, let's read this. If the sum of working set sizes, so again, you know, our modern systems have lots of processes. So, all the processes that are like active at a certain time, and of course, I think of the systems lab server, I guess, because it's part of my job to keep this thing up and running. And as you know, I get sort of annoyed when it gets slow, and which has happened a few times in our class. When all of the working sets for everything that's like actively being used, so all of you all who are like logged in and using browsers or editors or whatever, we take the sum of what's actively being used to all of those programs. As long as that's less than the main memory size, then it's great. We get fast access as things work out. But if there's so much going on that all the working sets add up to more than the main memory size, well, if stuff doesn't fit in main memory, where's it going to go? Well, onto disk, that's where virtual memory ends up going. So again, let me see. Our diagram here really just sort of shows, you know, physical memory is where our most recently used stuff is going to be, and it's going to be faster. But everything else goes on the disk. And as we've seen before, the disk, you know, my graph from last week, the disk is like, you know, could be 10,000 times slower than memory. So when there's more stuff in the working set than there's space in memory, there's going to be a lot of evictions from the cache of memory. And so, like, you know, this, you know, one of the pages of physical memory has to get evicted to put one of the, let's see, where's my, you know, you got to evict virtual page 4 to put 3 there. But wait, hey, maybe virtual page 4 was needed by that other process, and there's gonna be about to be a context switch, and now we need virtual page 4. But wait, that process that is running really needs virtual page 3. And meanwhile, 1 and 2 and 7 are all getting used all at once. So if like, if there's like, you know, 5 or 6 or 7, I mean, assuming there's this really small example here of 4 physical pages. But if there's more than that need to get used, they're constantly going to have to swap back and forth. 4, 3, 4, 3, that's just the example here. But that swap takes a bunch of time and it's called a page fault. And involves writing stuff out to the disk and then reading stuff off the disk back into memory, way slower than just using everything out of memory. So that process called swapping, where you're copying stuff from disk into memory and from memory onto the disk. And that's too much swapping is called thrashing, which is to say it's doing this like, you know, slow, awkward thing repeatedly. And it's a sort of, you know, it's a performance meltdown here. So this is when everything, you know, gets so congested and bad that the computer just sort of grinds nearly to a halt. And I always thought it was interesting when kind of before we had the common prevalence of solid state disks, our spinning hard drives like made noise, right? And I think those of you who used a computer, you know, 5 or 10 years ago are probably used to this sort of little clicking noise. You would often hear a lot of that happening when the computer was thrashing. So you could really like, you know, use your ears to determine that something, your computer was, you know, too much memory was in use and it was having to do a lot of swapping to the disk. And you would also notice that like, if you tried to, you know, switch from your web browser to your like spreadsheet program, well, the spreadsheet program's memory may have been written out to disk while you're using the web browser. So when you like go back to your spreadsheet, which, you know, as far as you were concerned was open and running and should be fine. But when you go to like click on it, it's like, whoa, you have to like wait. It like takes, you know, a bunch of time to like put it back on the screen. Maybe even like you see the, you know, the data getting loaded back in slowly. Sometimes this even happens with like a web browser tab that you haven't used in a long time. It has to like pull it up off of the disk instead of out of the nice fast memory. And you can, you know, you can even like cause this to happen by like loading too much stuff into memory. So, so that's thrashing and that's bad. You know, I think it's a lot less common now. For one thing, we have, I think, you know, successfully managed to buy computers with lots of memory in them. You know, now it's probably not unusual that you have maybe 8 gigabytes or maybe even 16 gigabytes of memory in a laptop computer of all things. So that's a lot of memory. But if you have a computer with low memory and you're running tons of stuff, thrashing becomes more likely and thrashing sucks. I think you agree with me or probably would agree if you experienced this. So that's the upsides and downsides to virtual memory as a big cache. But I want to talk about some of the other implications of this. Memory management, memory protection, translation, all that. So each process has its own virtual address space. Again, this process idea, you just can't, you know, you can't hear me talk about it enough, can you? Processes keep, you know, it's what all our computers do is in processes, and we love processes. So each process has its own memory space, and it can really just look at it as a simple array. There's byte with this low address, bytes with high addresses, can, you know, move stuff in, move stuff out, etc. Those virtual addresses, however, are not necessarily physical addresses. So the program can write things to low addresses, to big addresses. Doesn't really matter. The operating system address translation will end up, you know, deciding where those pages physically reside. And in fact, there are ways that processes can even share memory pages. So that we get some extra, you know, caching or extra efficiency there. So in this example, we have process one and process two, and they each have a bunch of pages. We'll say virtual page one for process one lives at physical page two, but virtual page one for process two is in physical page eight. I'll kind of go back to our example of the bomb program that you know and love. You know, Process one probably has a string for phase one that is some, you know, text mostly unique to that program. So, you know, this student's bomb stores its string in physical page two. And the next student's bomb has a string, but a different one in virtual page one. That'll be in physical page eight. So the two programs, even though they're accessing, you know, the same or very similar memory addresses, they're actually in different physical locations. You know, again, I had this example from OBJ dump before, where the thing at the bottom, this string had this address 402628 and 402608. But actually in physical memory, those are in totally different locations. The operating system and the virtual memory system just, you know, made that happen. Okay. So back to this. But let's look at virtual page two. So they each have virtual page two, and they are pointing to the same location here, physical page six. Why is that? Well, programs, you know, are not completely unique. In fact, you know, probably have seen just in your experience this semester with C programs that you'll see a lot of use of, like printf or string compare, or all these kind of common, what we'll call library functions that are provided by the C library or by other things on the system. And these are things that your programs use on a read-only basis. They're just reading those instructions and executing them. So there's really no reason for process one and process two to have separate copies of the code for doing this standard library stuff. So these two programs could really share the same memory pages that contain all those library functions. This would also be true because you probably have more experience with Java programs, you know, that import or include some libraries or jar files. You know, if you're running a lot of Java programs, they could all share the same common library code there. So this, it's easy when processes are only making reads, it's easy for them to share because you don't have to worry about the things changing in the middle of the program, but with writes. So that seems like a easy win, right? You can tell all these processes, hey, here's your memory you asked for, but actually you're like sharing it between a bunch of processes. And so when there's like a context switch from process one to process two, well, there's a good chance that shared library code is like nicely sitting there in the cache for when process two uses it, and it can run real fast. And so that's a win for virtual memory. So, okay, so that's that, nice for performance. So sharing code, cool, save space and make things faster. Let's also look at, you know, for argument of simplicity that, you know, again, our program can use whatever addresses it wants and let the virtual memory system really place it. And this also helps a lot when we're dealing with linking. Do you remember the linker, the LD program that you got to run that had a really long set of parameters? This was like the last step in making the Hello World program into an executable you can run. So the linker really has to put all the pieces together and provide, you know, give everything a memory address. So before the linker runs, you just have some assembly instructions on how to run the program, but like, what are those addresses really going to be? And when it makes a call, what address does it call? The linker is what kind of builds this whole executable program and gives everything an address. But the nice thing in this virtual memory system is that the linker can generate, you know, it can give all the compiled programs an entry point right around 400000, and everyone can kind of, you know, have their main function around there, but they never collide with each other. In systems before virtual memory, it would be really complicated to say, well, if these two programs are both going to run at the same time, well, how are we going to figure out who goes here and who goes there? So virtual memory simplifies that linking process. There's a whole bunch of other stuff here about runtime stack that we'll talk about during Attack Lab, and memory maps and whatnot. But this just makes linking and then running the programs way simpler when you don't have to worry about oh, are these memory addresses going to collide, as we say? So that is sort of a quick look at the memory management part of virtual memory. And then finally, there's this issue of protection, which is, again, you know, I've made the sort of promise that processes don't make each other break, don't interfere with each other. So this is one of the tables from chapter 9. So PTE, page table entries. So again, this is the thing, just referring back to my older diagram, page table entry is the thing that maps virtual pages to physical pages. And we have this little valid bit here to say if something's in memory or if it needs to be swapped in from the disk. Well, if the page entry, in addition to a valid bit, we have additional bits, you know, and bits are, you know, a one or a zero, pretty small. But for each page of memory, for each virtual page, so again, process I has 0, 1, and 2 virtual pages, and J has VP 0, 1, and 2. So each of these pages has permission bits. And remember, we had bits for permissions on files also. So this is not an unusual idea. So for each of these pages, we actually have read, write, and execute bits that are yes, you know, 1 or 0, yes or no. So we can mark pages readable, which is, of course, you see they're all ones in this case. Most pages ought to be readable, but some are not writable, and that's actually a good thing in this case with physical page 6, that one process I does not write to physical page 6, so but it only reads from it, so it doesn't have to worry about interfering with process J that can write to physical page 6. So we generally are trying to avoid two processes writing to the same memory at the same time. But for reads, they can share the same physical page. And, you know, again, we get the benefits of caching and all that stuff. So what about execute? Why do we have a bit for that? Well, we want to be able to execute those library functions, those common things you want to call. But there are other parts of the code that just contain, you know, data or other non-executable stuff. And so this was actually added later on. And when we talk about buffer overflows soon, we're going to see why we would want to be able to mark certain parts of memory as not executable. You would think, well, you know, just don't execute. You know, if you don't want to execute those memory addresses, just don't jump to there and execute them. But turns out, a malicious, clever user, and all of you will know how to do this soon, could kind of trick a program into executing other parts of memory. So that's a useful security feature to set something not executable. These permission bits are actually checked by the MMU memory management unit. So again, this is a piece of the hardware built in to the processor. Again, our computer hardware was designed explicitly to make this sort of virtual memory possible. And again, you know, earlier computers didn't have this and weren't able to do the fancy virtual memory stuff that we need for our multi-process operating systems.
I have a quick question.
Yes.
A kind of clarification on like the virtual address. So the virtual address isn't actually where the data is located physically?
Exactly, yes.
Well, I'm kind of confused on that. Like, I thought the memory address. Okay, so is memory address different from virtual address?
I guess it depends. Yeah, when we said memory address before, we weren't being that specific. And so I like to come back to this because you've seen OBJ dump, you've seen all these addresses before. So when you're in GDB and you see instruction pointer 400DA7, the top left here, right? Well, you know, I would say that's the memory address of where this call instruction is for initialize bomb, right? So when I called that a memory address, I said, okay, the computer is going to go to memory at that address and get the bytes for that instruction. So is that the physical address? Well, I wasn't being specific before, but no, it isn't. I guess you could say we were lying to you all along. But it's a good lie, right? Because we're essentially lying to all the processes in the system and saying, here's your 400DA7. And then at the same time, someone on the same computer, their 400DA7 contains different bytes. And we're sort of like lying to both of them because actually in physical memory, they're somewhere totally different. And these programs in OBJ dump and GDB are never going to show you physical memory addresses because they don't even know. Just ask the kernel for memory at this address. And the kernel says, well, I know this process is 400DA7 is here. And this other process has 400DA7 somewhere else. So yeah, 400DA7 is a virtual address. And it gets translated into a physical address by the operating system, which is the operating system understands things outside the little bubble of the process. So, but that's a thing that the process doesn't understand or need to understand.
So that's why, like, if we had like two different bonds, they would have like the same virtual address, even though the actual, I guess, physical data is like they're in different locations.
Yeah, exactly. And this is why I use the bomb program as an example here, because yeah, like you really have looked at the memory addresses of it. As far as process is concerned, virtual addresses are the only memory addresses, but they're not real. I guess that's what we mean by virtual, you know? So our bomb program, I mean, here we're saying VP0, 1, and 2, just to use small examples, but really that was 401DA2 or whatever. And when that call or that move instruction executed, the operating system and the MMU together made that little translation, found it in physical memory, and then gave it to the process. And the process didn't really know where it really came from, and that's okay. In fact, the system works out such that it's really better that the process doesn't know about all that. The only time it's really an issue is like, you know, if it had to get swapped in from disk, then there's a page fault and it gets slowed down a little bit. But the process still gets its memory, whether it's fast or slow. So this is kind of all comes down to, well, are we talking about from the point of view of the process? Because, you know, we're giving the process an illusion of this world of simple virtual memory addresses. And, hey, process, you have your own register as well. You know, there's 5,000 processes on Systems Lab, and we tell them each they have their own registers. I mean, that we don't have 5,000 sets of registers on the physical hardware. But the processes don't need to know that, right? So I guess you could say all of this stuff. I mean, that's why I called it an illusion, right? I mean, all of this stuff are kind of, you know, tricks, but they're good tricks, and they, you know, accomplish what we want. So I appreciate the question, because that's exactly how I want us to think about this. What else do you want to ask about? I don't actually see the chat window. I wonder if anyone's using that. No one, do you know what this thing sup on the left is?
No.
So why didn't y'all ask? that stands for supervisor, and that is actually certain pages of memory can be marked as sort of privileged for certain processes. You know, supervisor also is known as root or the super user on a system. So certain pages in memory can have sort of special reserved for the kernel and other kind of powerful processes. So anyway, that's another sort of like security feature that we're not really going into much here. But the page table is, you know, crucial to controlling what processes can access what memory. You know, if the page table is wrong, you know, if process I can access process J's memory, then like our virtual memory system has failed, because, you know, everything lives in memory somewhere. So you might think, oh, well, I can read someone else's solution to phase one, but also like, when someone's typing their password into their browser or into SSH, like that ends up in memory somewhere, and we can't have one user's process reading some other user's password. So when memory protection breaks down, that has huge implications for security and privacy. And so these virtual memory systems have to be you know, very careful and checked closely to not have serious bugs in them, or else our you know, our security systems break down. And you know, that has big implications these days when, you know, systems with virtual memory and processes also run all of your, you know, all of your financial stuff and all of your health stuff and all the important stuff in the world these days, you know, is really running through systems with virtual memory. And if the security stuff built into them doesn't work, then we have lots of problems. I'm sure you've heard about various data breaches and security issues that come up all the time. So important for folks in computer science, if we're gonna make these systems work right at all, we gotta know a lot about virtual memory. So that's kind of the three pronged justification for virtual memory: caching, memory management, memory protection. So I'm gonna talk a little bit about, well, you know, how, you know, what happens. So I, you know, I said before, oh, we're turning this virtual memory address into a physical one. I mean, the operating system's doing it without like telling the process. Well, a little more about what that looks like. So we have this thing, memory management unit, MMU, built into the processor. So it receives a virtual address for some process, and its job is to translate it into where it is physically. It uses the page table to do that. But of course, the page table, you know, it's a bunch of bits and bytes. Addresses and valid bit and read and write and execute bits. You know, all that's ones and zeros that has to be stored somewhere, and actually that gets stored in memory, which might seem weird because it's like, well, wait, the page table is where what tells us where to find things in memory, but the page table itself is located in the main memory? Well, yes, it is. You know, the operating system knows it's in a specific important location that the regular processes can't access. But yeah, to do a lookup, the MMU has to access memory, check the page table, and then get the physical address, and then send the physical address to memory and fetch that data. You know, so we have this like five-step thing here. So that's, again, comes back to this idea, well, virtual memory, this should be like really inefficient. How is this even working out? Well, it actually gets worse, because this is the page hit. This is the good case. What about the miss or the page fault when, in this case, the virtual address needed is not in memory, it's on a disk somewhere, the super slow disk. So that means that the MMU gets a page table entry from memory, but the thing is not in memory that it needs, so it has to generate the page fault and run some code, which is in the kernel, to solve the page fault, which means evict something from the disk, evict something from memory to put it on disk, and then read a page from the disk back into memory, which is the one that's being requested. So now we have this like seven steps of stuff just to get a memory page. So this is like super slow and complicated. And how is this not super crazy slow? Sometimes it is super crazy slow. So complicated. And there's just like all of this back and forth between MMU and memory. So this can be really slow. So the problem here is that you know, we need caches for this to work well at all. And usually this stuff in the page table you know, would be cached in the L1, the fastest cache on the processor. But those things could get, you know, could be evicted when, because the L1 cache is needed for other data too, and the L1 cache is small. So the solution, which just is pretty much the solution for nearly all performance problems in our computers for decades, is add another cache. Remember, we had that whole pyramid triangle with tons and tons of caches. And it's still, we still have performance problems, so we add another cache. There's a special type of cache called translation look aside buffer, which is a funny name, but it does kind of describe it well. So a special cache specifically for holding page table memory addresses, because we need those things to be cached, because translating virtual addresses to physical addresses happens all the time for everything, for instructions, for the instruction pointer is using virtual addresses, the moves and memory accesses, reads and writes, all using virtual addresses. So there's a special cache containing page table entries built into the hardware. So when we have performance problems, tell the hardware people we need more caches. And that's what happens here. So now the MMU has a special cache. You see, it's called look aside because it really is sort of like, you know, in this diagram, it's, you know, kind of making a left turn before it goes to memory. So the virtual address request goes into MMU. MMU can check the TLB, the translation look aside buffer, to translate that into a physical address, and then boom, now it's only making one request to physical memory, and then reply, you know, giving that reply, step number five, back to the CPU. So this is great. We've minimized how many, you know, relatively slow accesses to physical memory occur. So that's the translation look aside buffer doing what we wanted to do with a TLB hit. But of course, like all caches, we want hits, you know, most of the time, but it's not guaranteed all the time. In fact, I mean, there's a certain compulsory miss, right? Because the TLB is going to start out empty. So how does it get anything? Well, everything really does come from memory. So a miss on the TLB would mean, well, what we needed wasn't there. So it has to get fetched from memory, but then kept in the TLB for next time. So, you know, with the miss, we're back to where we were before in looking in memory for the page table. But the TLB caches it so that hopefully that happens once, but not too many more times. So we say, well, misses on the TLB are rare. Why? We can answer this in one word.
Cache.
Did you say cache?
Yeah.
That's pretty close. I mean, I've already said the TLB is a cache, so I think that one's already taken, but you're very close.
Sweet. I meant like a backup.
Well, okay. But it is, let's put it this way, it is a word that we introduced while talking about caches, you know, when talking about the library metaphor and all that kind of stuff. Do you need hints? Let's see. I know it's in these slides too. Let me check. Locality to the rescue. So, the answer is locality. So that, the principle of locality is what, makes it, you know, convinces us that TLB misses can and should be rare. Again, because of locality, those programs you're running, like that instruction pointer, is really going to be dealing with virtual memory addresses all next to each other. So if the TLB caches the first one, everything after it for some amount of time is also going to be cached. You know, your program's going to do loops accessing those same addresses over and over. You know, you're going to be dealing with arrays that are all next to each other. All these things that happen because of locality mean that, you know, we'll have a huge, you know, 99% and more of memory addresses will be serviced by this cache, the special cache for memory addresses, the TLB. So, again, we have this like complicated system that could get really slow. And again, you know, thrashing ends up getting slow. A lot of misses on the page table, can be slow, but if we choose our caches right and our programs have the correct locality, then everything works out great. And so we've somehow managed to make this crazy complicated thing run fast. And it really does, because the fact is your computers are fast and you probably haven't had your computer thrashing recently, making it super slow to just like open up a program. Am I right? I hope so. Summing up virtual memory, from the programmer's or program's point of view, which is kind of how we've been addressing most of these questions, the process is own address space. So this is why, you know, Emmanuel's asking before, like, so wait, have you been, you know, what these memory addresses you've been talking about all along, they're not real memory addresses, and they weren't. But to the process, from the process point of view, it was memory address. It's real, like, you know. What is real? But yeah, we virtual stuff is all that processes really know about. And also processes, memory space can't be messed up by other processes. Our operating system guarantees that. Now, you know, if I am the operating system, you know, I could go and modify memory inside a program. In fact, you can do this with GDB. You know, you could, you know, if you're at a breakpoint in GDB, you can say, you know what, I want to change this register to something else. Or I want to change this memory byte to something else. Like, you can do that in GDB. Remember, because I kind of tell you, GDB is sort of like superpower. Now, you know, you could even go and, like, when you're in, you know, phase five of Bomb Lab, you could say, well, you know what, I'm going to change this thing that says, you know, whether or not explode bomb gets called, I'm going to change it from 1 to 0. And you would think, wow, wait, so could I have just solved Bomb Lab by just, like, you know, doing that the whole time? Well, no, we have defenses against that. But the point is that when everything's working normally, regular processes can't mess with memory for another program. And then from the systems point of view, the operating system, this makes memory more efficient. Of course, locality is what determines all of this because we're dealing with caches that hold a smaller portion of the total sum of everything, and it tends to work out well. It makes memory management for the process simpler, and also gives us this protection and security by checking permissions on memory pages. So the programmer and the operating system kind of both see this virtual memory thing differently, but it works out well for everyone. And finally, I kind of just went back to the beginning of chapter 9, where they kind of say, well, okay, virtual memory is central in that all of, you know, everything our programs do, from, you know, from the instruction pointer to the variables to, you know, how the assembler works, how the linker works, how, you know, what makes all the processes work. Even the hardware is designed around this, with the MMU and the look side buffer and all that stuff. Everything that our modern operating systems do deal with virtual memory. So it's in the middle of everything. It's powerful. It really allows our applications to do whatever they want with memory without causing big problems. Deals with reading and writing files to disk. But finally, as you know, something's powerful, it often is also dangerous, and that is true. Have you seen this segmentation fault? That is when, you know, one way that things go wrong with virtual memory. So. You know, every time they're dealing with variables or pointers or library functions, virtual memory is used. And when things go wrong, you get segmentation fault. Often, you know, and if you've been writing C programs, it'll just happen to a lot of you in your do BGFG function in Shell Lab. If you did something a little bit off with pointers or memory accesses, you get the segmentation fault error. And that's when the operating system says this process is trying to do something with memory address that it shouldn't do. Did you know that segmentation fault is actually a good outcome? Most people would say, oh, I hate it when it says segmentation fault. That's my program crashing. But actually, you know, you could write a handler. You can make a signal handler for sig seg v, and, you know, you can have your program ignore segmentation faults if you want to. But that's actually a terrible idea, because that segmentation fault stops your program before it does something totally wrong. And, you know, even worse than crashing is a program that is just wrong and never tells you that it's wrong. So segmentation fault, you hate it, but actually it's better than the alternative. The same way I'm, you know, telling people that, like, compiler errors, like, it's actually trying to help you by telling you what's wrong. So, you know, pay attention to these things, and they'll help you fix problems. So that's my big picture for you on virtual memory. And we will... get you back into GDB and Chapter 3 in Attack Lab coming up soon. So, what do you think?
Question. Person? Are segmentation faults, like, related to, like, memory leaks?
Well, not exactly. I mean, a memory leak is generally like a program, you know, allocating memory and then kind of forgetting about it and leaving it lying around. So that it's kind of like, you know, leaving stuff, leaving stuff behind that, you know, what's a good metaphor? I mean, like, you know, if you're like carrying a garbage bag that has a hole in it and you keep dropping stuff along the path, like, and not coming back for it, like, it's wasteful, but it's probably not going to cause a vertical crash. So memory leak is more of a wasteful thing that's going to hurt performance more than it is going to cause a crash. Mm-mm. Well, anyway, have you dealt with memory leaks before? Has that come up in other courses?
Yeah, in Java, they were telling us about like garbage collecting and how like in C programs and like C++, like you have to manually like handle garbage collecting.
Yeah, and actually, chapter 9 has a whole bit on garbage collection that that we didn't really get to. I mean, Java programs do this for you automatically, but also like Java programs get a lot slower because they do this for you automatically. So like, there is a price to be paid by the Java garbage collector, and that's actually one of the people who don't like it when their Java programs get slow are usually pulling their hair out from the garbage collector. It's like, oh no, the garbage collector ran and everything got slow. So it, you know, it takes time for this thing to go fix your memory errors for you. So you know, the C programmer is like, look, don't garbage collect for me. I know what I'm doing. Well, we'll see. You know, until things go wrong. So that's sort of why generally people would, you know, programs would consider writing a C program harder than a Java program, but potentially much faster because you control when things really happen. Anyway, I'm glad you're making that connection there. And yeah, there's a whole thing about garbage collection in chapter 9. This is really just like the core concepts that we kind of want to get you ready for OS. And I think you'll deal with garbage collection and more memory stuff a lot more in your OS class. Is that true, David and TAs who've taken OS? I think so. That is today's class, y'all. Hope you're well, and I guess we will shut this down.